Hello, everybody, and welcome to the Worship Artists Essay Podcast, where we have conversations about faith and music with South African artists. And I'm really excited today to have Seb Goldswain on the show. Seb is a professional musician and worship director at Hillcrest Baptist Church. And we had a good chat about what it means to be a musician, what it means to be a creator, and how everything we do is to be done to the glory of God. So I hope that you enjoy. Please share this with your friends, and thanks for tuning in. This is our country. All right, well, Seb, thanks so much for joining me today. I'm really excited to be chatting to you.
Yeah, thanks, Luke. Thank you for having me.
Cool. So just tell everybody who you are and how you fit into the music scene here in South Africa.
Well, my name is Seb Goldswain. I have the immense honor of being a professional musician and performing guitar player. I have been doing this, I suppose, for around about 8 years now. I suppose since I finished high school. When I finished high school, all I wanted to do was music. I had a couple of experiences in my life which were very influential for me. And I just decided that music was pretty much what I was made to do in terms of my career. And I loved it so much, I figured I'd throw myself into the deep end and give it a go. So when I finished high school, I went to university and studied jazz at UKZN. And I had the immense privilege of learning there for 6 years. And I ended up getting a BPrac Muz degree with majors in performance and composition and arranging and electroacoustics, so recording and stuff like that. And pretty much in my career, in my performing career, I kind of lean towards, I'll do whatever. So whatever people want me to do in terms of style or playing or festivals or anything, I'll do anything. But people seem to book me more and more and more for solo acoustic, the fingerstyle type of thing. And so that's where I found myself kind of focusing my career on.
Okay. Yeah.
Yeah.
Cool. Yeah. I saw you at Andy's Acoustic Forum a couple of years back. I think that's where I first found out who you were.
Yes, and, that was 2015, 2016?
Somewhere around there, yeah, a couple of years ago.
Yeah.
And it was cool. I brought my sister along to watch. It was her first time coming to Andy's.
Oh,
and
cool.
She's a guitar player and she loves, you know, Tommy Emmanuel and Steve Vai and all these players. And so it was really cool that you were there because we really enjoyed your music. And I bought the album. I bought Pictures of a Thousand Words. And I was so blown away when I was reading the words inside the CD cover. So I just want to read this bottom section. I just want to read this bottom section if I can.
Sure.
So you say, a special thanks to the light come into the world, the one through whom all things were made, the redeemer of my soul, and the way, the truth, and the life, Jesus Christ. Thank you for making me, loving me, molding me, revealing your irresistible truth to me, and for dying for me. All to you I owe. And I remember just reading that and thinking, that's so cool, because I didn't really expect it out of an artist at that place. So so how's your faith been part of this whole music journey that you've been on?
Well, I suppose it has helped me immensely. I know that you know, when you look at scripture, we are to interpret everything through the lens of scripture, and we are to, as best we can, to have the mind of Christ, as Paul commands us in Colossians, I think. And you know, so in everything, I try and live in accordance with God's revealed will. And you know, ultimately it's his world, he made it, he sets the rules. And so the best thing for any person, the freest any person can be, is when they live in accordance with their creator. So practically the way that's worked out in my life is when I started music, in all fairness, looking back on it, I found that music was a way and means of glorifying myself. You know, kind of like trying to cultivate my own name, my own fame, and kind of be the master of my own destiny, as it were. And and I could see that that's what I was working towards. That was where my heart and my treasure was in the fame of my name. And I was saved at that point. I was saved when I was 14, but I stopped attending church for a number of years. And I wasn't attending church or reading the Bible or anything like that at that point. And I just felt the kind of like the hopelessness of this pursuit. You know, my mindset and my worldview was that, well, I know that God loves me and God wants the best for me. And so therefore I'm going to be self-obsessed with myself and my music. And that must be what God wants for me. And I found, as I did music, as I was exposed to the world more and more and more, I found like a sense of hopelessness, in the world, and a sense of hopelessness in seeking my own fame and recognition. Mm-hmm. And I ended up, going to a couple of churches before I settled in the church I'm in now. And the Lord has been very, very gracious in basically kind of like pulling back and tearing away selfishness from me. And I'm, you know, he still has a lot of work to do with me, but it became very apparent very soon that the reason I was doing my music career was for myself and for my own glory. And so the first thing the Lord did was he went and stuck me in my church band, and I'm used to playing with professionals, and you know, I was now forced to play with some great players and some players who struggled, as if I could put it like that. And so it was a very, very humbling experience. And the Lord has used my church band to humble me immensely in terms of where I think I'm at, and he made me realize that I might have learned a lot musically at university. But I definitely had failed to grow in my people skills and in my loving for my brothers and sisters at church. So, he kind of like changed everything up for me the moment I joined my church, and more and more and more, I'm convinced by the truth in 1 Corinthians 10 verse 31, which says, "Whether you eat or drink or whatever you do, do all to the glory of God."
Glory of God, yeah.
And, I think it was a non-Christian. It was, Chris Martin from Coldplay. He said that someone asked him in an interview, "How do you write music? How do you compose music?" And he said, "I don't compose anything. It's already composed. I just have to like reach up into the air and try and grab hold of some of it." And that's a sentiment I've heard from lots of composers. The fact that they don't feel like they've truly come up with anything original or that they've even composed. They feel like they receive compositions which are there already. And I believe that, you know, God is the creator. We are sub creators because we're made in his image. And so I believe that all good music is from God and a gift from God for us. And so the more I can help make people happy, the more I can show the glory of God as creator through making music, then the happier I am in my career.
Awesome. Yeah, that's awesome. Are you still playing at your church now?
I am indeed. So I now am the music director and worship leader at my church.
Is this Hillcrest Baptist?
This is Hillcrest Baptist, correct.
Okay, that's cool. All right, so you travel about during the week, and then on Sundays you're at your church leading the team.
Yeah, absolutely. I try not to miss Sundays. I know there's a band, POD, the kind of like hard rock band from the 90s. And they always made the point of, because they, you know, obviously made it huge and toured a lot. And they made a rule where every 2 or 3 weeks they had to lead worship at their church. And it was a form of accountability just to make sure that, you know, you don't get sucked into the world too much, no matter how good it seems, no matter how great the opportunities might seem in the world. They were always brought back to their church, and the church held them accountable in that way. So it's kind of a rule I've made where I try not to miss Sundays as far as possible, unless it's a huge opportunity and I ask my elders and they agree and they think it's good for me. Sunday services are definitely my highest priority in terms of planning my week.
Okay, yeah, I think Casting Crowns, if I'm not mistaken, had a similar rule, because they're all working in their own church at different roles, and I'm sure I heard them say the same type of thing. They go and they tour, but then they always make sure that they're still invested in their home community as much as they can be.
Absolutely,
which is so important.
And that accountability is huge. I mean, you know, when you see these kind of, you know, when you hear about Christian artists who've fallen away, How often did it start with the fact that they weren't held accountable by their churches, or that they weren't even members of churches, and they didn't have a local body that they could call their own congregation?
Yeah, definitely. Okay, so would you call, because you write mostly instrumental music.
Correct.
If I'm not mistaken. So would you call that worship music as well? We've got this mindset that worship is singing songs together at church, which is part of it.
Yeah.
But how do you experience your own music as worship as well?
Well, 1 Corinthians 10:31, whether you eat or drink or whatever you do, do all to the glory of God.
And Paul
makes the point there by taking the most mundane things like eating and drinking. I mean, if you take eating, for example, you look at plants or giraffes, like plants just sit in the ground and their feet are in the soil and they just suck up nutrients through the earth. Mm-hmm. And giraffes just eat leaves nonstop. And he could have made us like that. And we would have plenty of nutrition from, you know, eating leaves or sucking nutrients from the ground. But instead, he gave us infinite variety in terms of food. And, you know, it's unbelievable that he grows fruit on trees and just that, you know, he makes everything for us and we can eat it and enjoy it. And we get so used to the mundane things like eating when it should be an act of worship in itself, is seeing God as creator in our eating. And so I kind of view that in the same way with my music. Every time I get to play, I'm always reminded and very grateful for the fact that God has given me a talent, which he's also allowed me to make my career out of my talent. And that's such a big blessing. So I'm always grateful for that. When you look at music theory and just how it fits in with science and with nature, and it's just genius. And so when I'm composing, I'm aware of God who made all the rules and all of that. And I think that's amazing. And that fits into, how I glorify God through my career. But as far as worship, I would definitely draw a distinction between my personal worship of God and my appreciation and glorifying of God in my career. I would definitely distinguish that from corporate worship at church, for example.
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah. So corporate worship in church is to be the people of God gathering. So the word church comes from the Greek word ekklesia, which means gathering. Mm-hmm. And so when the people gather, they are to, you know, if you look at the examples in all the way through the Old Testament and as Paul describes for us in the New Testament, the way singing works is, and you see it all the way through the Psalms, you know, I will sing the praises of my Lord. And then it goes on to say reasons why we should do that. And so as we sing about the truth of God, that causes us to respond in worship to God. So worship is simply the response that God deserves when we hear about his goodness and when we hear about his attributes.
Yes. Yeah. Ascribe to the Lord the glory that he is due. I can't remember if that's the right phrasing.
Absolutely.
I just read that the other day in Psalm 29, I think. And that's what it's all about. Yes.
Absolutely.
Okay. Cool. So I had a little sort of smile to myself when I was reading your heroes and role models here in your CD cover.
Yes.
Because it's mostly music guys, Steve Morse, Tommy Emmanuel, Doyle Dykes, Pat Metheny, and then on the end, these two theologians, James White and Charles Spurgeon. And I thought, Spurgeon, seriously? Which is awesome. I mean, that's cool. So just tell us who those two guys are and how they've inspired you.
Well, I think I'll start with Charles Spurgeon first. So so for those who don't know, Charles Spurgeon, he's probably the greatest Baptist preacher of all time. And he preached in London in the Metropolitan Tabernacle Church, I think it was called. And it was kind of like the world's, at that time, it was like the world's biggest mega church, I suppose you could say. And Charles Spurgeon was, when you just read up about the man, he was just, he had a mind on him second to none. There's a famous story of him and David Livingstone. And David Livingstone, the famous missionary, went to go see Charles Spurgeon. And he asked him, he said, how do you do two men's worth of work each week? And Charles Spurgeon said, well, you must remember there are two of us doing my work. There's, you know, myself and the Holy Spirit. And he was just so prolific. The amount of sermons he wrote, there's just, you know, unbelievable facts and history and how the Lord used that man so greatly and how influential he was. Yeah. And I think where Charles Spurgeon became so influential for me was I had his morning and evening daily devotional, which I recommend to absolutely every single Christian in the world. And it was basically, you know, a daily thought on a verse or something like that. And it was just so powerful. And I read that every day for 2 years. Mm-hmm. And that totally, you know, as I started going back to church and started getting involved, someone recommended I get that devotional. And that truly has changed and helped form me as a Christian in my formative years as becoming a Christian, I suppose.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And then as for James White, so I can be fairly confrontational and hopefully in a good way, but as I became a Christian, I started seeing these great truths in scripture. Like, you know, Jesus said, I am the way and the truth and the life. And he said, the Father and I are one. And in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. And, you know, these astounding truths that God, who created the universe, came down to earth and he became a man just like us. And, you know, these truths are something you can sit and think about, and we should think about every single day for hours and ponder and be grateful for. And then you would see people groups who actively disagree with that. So in my area, the biggest antagonistic group, I suppose, are the Jehovah's Witnesses. And so I started inviting them in and, you know, asking, and I'd like to share the gospel with them and talk to them and see what they believe. And I've got a whole bunch of their literature. And so that's become, you know, kind of like a part of what I do is I love reaching the cults and people groups who actively deny the deity of Christ in whichever way they choose to. And as I started, you know, dealing with that, I found that I'd start getting really good objections from them. And so I went into the internet and I'd be looking for answers to these objections. And the one source or the one ministry I kept on receiving good answers for, and eventually I just went to that website for the answers, was Alpha and Omega Ministries, run by Dr. James White. And so Dr. James White is an American apologist and doctor and theologian. And he's done over 150 moderated debates, and he's kind of like a role model for me in a sense, just to see, I went to a debate of his in Durban, and just to see his boldness and, you know, his ability to stand up in a room full of Muslims and to share the gospel with them, you know, and just how bold he was. And I found him a great example. I'm also fortunate enough to know him. So funnily enough, because I thanked him in the album, when he came here in 2015, I think, he came to Durban for a couple of debates. And so I went to him after one of his debates and I gave him my CD and I said, thank you so much. You're in the liner notes. I thanked you in the liner notes. So here's a copy of the album. And lo and behold, I didn't realize this, but he's actually a huge fan of acoustic guitar music, and he loves, he loves listening to acoustic guitar music while he's studying and preparing for, and, you know, preparing for debates and writing books. And so he thanked me and kind of made mention of my CD on his talk show. And when he came back to Durban last year, I had the privilege of kind of like carrying him around for 3 days and taking him to debates and just getting to know him, and even talk to some Mormons with him. That was a lot of fun. So yeah, absolutely. He's also just a really huge role model, and he's very much influenced the way I think that being a Christian should fit in with my job, and being bold and fearless in the face of dissenters and adversity.
Yeah. Now, I just love your heart for witness like that. It's so easy for us to get comfortable at church and become our own little inside community without that heart for reaching out. So just hearing you speak like this is awesome. It's fantastic.
Oh, great. Absolutely. And I think all Christians should be pursuing, I think it should be on the hearts of Christians to see the lost saved, because we too once were lost. And you know, there's no difference between me and the unbeliever down the road. The only difference is that God showed his grace to me and saved me. And so we should long for the same goodness for those around us.
Yeah. Amen. Absolutely. All right. Well, tell us about about your guitar. Like, well, your guitaring. How did you start out? Where did you start playing guitar?
Funnily enough, I took up guitar when I got to high school by mistake. I'd never done music in my life before. And when I got to high school, I went to a boarding school, and they sent home an email to our parents saying, you know, we offer music lessons. Please let us know if your son would like to sign up for music lessons. Mm-hmm. And so my mom said to me, would you like to do guitar? And I said, no, thanks. I'll be busy this term. And I didn't realize that, you know, I got home from my first week of school and she bought me a guitar and said, well, oops, sorry, I'd bought it already. And she'd signed me up for lessons. So I thought, okay, well, I'll go to lessons just to make my mom happy. And then I'll drop it after, a term or two. And it soon became the highlight of my week, going to my guitar lessons. And my school has a really great choir, the Kersney Choir. And so we got to travel the world and I went to Europe with the choir and it was just such a great experience, kind of seeing, you know, thousands of choirs, literally thousands of choirs with professional musicians from all around the world performing and seeing how big music is and how you can make a living out of it. And that was amazing. And so I decided to do music. And when I got to university, at that point I was deep into Stevie Ray Vaughan and Dan Podlansky and Philip Sace and all the blues guys. Yeah. And that's all I wanted to do. And when I was exposed to jazz, then that kind of changed things up and I had to study jazz for 6 years and I loved it and I loved the art form, but it wasn't me. I'm not a jazz musician and it doesn't really resonate with me to be a jazz guitar player. So I have learned, and to this day, basically all I practice each day is jazz because it's really hard and it affects everything I do positively. But yeah, so I kind of went down the jazz road, and that's changed and influenced the way I play. And I suppose the biggest turning point then was when I first bought an album in London by a guitar player called Tommy Emmanuel. And yes. I'd heard about Tommy Emmanuel and, I'd heard he's this great acoustic player, and I'd watched some videos and I thought, wow, he's really good, but nothing really spoke to me. And so I was actually in London on holiday and I got lost. So I went into a music store and I thought, well, if I'm going to be lost, I might as well get some music and listen to some music while being lost. So I went and bought a CD and ripped it onto my computer, then copied it across to my phone. And I sat and listened to this album called Little by Little by Tommy Emmanuel. Okay. And I just, the first song on that album, Halfway Home, is just one of my absolute favorite pieces of music. And I remember hearing him play this whole composition on one guitar, and it was this stunning composition, you know, like really, really something worthy of like Paul McCartney or George Harrison. And just to hear, you know, the melody being spoken so clearly and beautiful chords and this rich, consistent bass line, all at one time by the same guy. And I had to go learn that piece. So I went and bought myself a thumb pick and I started learning the Tommy Emmanuel style, and that soon kind of spread to other players in that genre, like Doyle Dykes and Joe Robinson and, a bunch of other guys. And then eventually Chet Atkins and Merle Travis. Mm-hmm. And so I think that, you know, that kind of like totally enveloped me. And everything I'd learned in terms of the blues and jazz, it came together so well. In the style of music I play, so it seemed like it was a style made for me, as it were.
Okay, well, you said something when I saw you at Andy's, where you said something to the effect of, you learned all about how to play jazz, but you never learned how to make a living off of it, or they taught you everything about how to play, but not how to make a living.
Correct.
When you were at university.
Yeah.
But now you're making a living. So how did you learn how to actually make it work?
Well, the first thing I had to do was make a couple of economic decisions. And chief amongst those was the fact that every time I did a gig with a band, I had to pay them. And I figured that in the long term, you know, for me to give literally 70 or 80% of my earnings away to other people at every single one of my shows, I thought, sure, that's an economic model that might not work for me in the long run. So I, you know, at that time, I just happened to, you know, in the Lord's providence, I discovered Tommy Emmanuel and started learning that stuff just as I was coming out of varsity.
Okay.
And so I heard the bass, I heard the drums, I heard the melody, I heard the chords, I heard, you know, entertainment on one guitar at a time. And I thought that's exactly what I need to do. So I started doing solo acoustic shows. Even though I was pretty awful at it at first, I loved it so much I did it. And I've, you know, kind of dedicated myself to that style of music and to that style of playing now. And it's been great to see that as it picks up, you know, like I've been very fortunate, and a couple of people have asked to sponsor me in terms of different things, and, you know, booking agents wanting to represent me, and, you know, just a lot of blessings, really, really good blessings from a lot of people around me who just hear what I do and want to do something with me. And so I think I'm very fortunate in that way. To kind of like be self-sufficient in terms of running my own business and all of that. And then the other thing I teach on the side as well. So I can't escape that, teaching guitar. Then I am employed at my church. So I'm my pastor's pastoral assistant, I suppose, and the worship leader. And that's pretty much a full-time job itself as well. So burning the candle at both ends.
So I've also seen you doing a lot of workshops and performances at schools and such.
Correct.
So tell us about your heart for giving back in that way.
Well, in essence, I view my music and what I do as not my own. And it's not about me at all. It's, you know, when you think of, you know, great pieces of music, you don't think about, well, you shouldn't think about how great the artist is in you know, as the core starting point. It should be, how great is our God that he gives us all this amazing music. And we thank him so much that he's given us, you know, this music through Mozart or through George Gershwin or, you know, whatever. And I kind of view anything I do in that way in the same way, that if I get an opportunity to perform for people and it seems like, you know, it's going to work and it seems like a good thing, then of course I'll do it, because the performances aren't about me. It's about the audience, and you want the audience to have a good time, and you want the audience to be affected and for them to be blessed. And, you know, I depending on the show, I might sometimes get explicitly Christian in what I say, but usually I just view it as a job, you know. So if I go on stage, just like, you know, if a plumber started, you know, if you called in a plumber to work on your basin and he started spiritualizing the problem that you have with your basin, you'd kind of say, thanks, plumber, we're going to get someone else. just fix the pipe. Absolutely. And so I view my job in the same way. It's a blessing that I have this job. And so whenever I get to share it with people around me, that's a huge blessing that I am happy to serve others, you know. I'm happy to serve other people in that way.
Cool. Okay. All right. So let's talk about Pictures of a Thousand Words.
Yeah.
You sent me a couple of songs. Okay. Well, I bought the album back then, but there's a couple of songs that we'll play. Okay. So, well, let me play Let There Be Light, and then you can just give us a few thoughts about it afterwards.
Yeah, absolutely.
We'll be right back. Cool. So tell us about the song.
Well, Let There Be Light. So when I started composing that album, I was very, very influenced by an American band called the Dixie Dregs, founded by one of my favorite guitar players of all time, Steve Morse. And, you know, they kind of like were hard to define in terms of genre. And they eventually settled on the label of electric chamber music, I think that's what they called themselves. Just because, they just, you know, they played country, they played hard rock, they played folk, they played baroque music. Mm-hmm. And it was totally organic. It just all fit together in a way which was totally unique and also very natural sounding. It didn't sound forced. And so being very influenced by them, I wanted to create a piece of music to start the album off, which would kind of like have movements to it. You know, like a classical composer would, rather than a songwriter, you know, someone who writes a verse chorus type of song. And so the song, I just started writing a piece of music, and as I kind of started going through it, it took me about a year to compose. And I kind of felt that it was going in different ways. You know, it kept on going through very different changes. You know, just in terms of feel, in terms of harmony, rhythm, the whole way through the song. And so what I tried to do, and if you listen to the song again, is it's basically the 6 days of creation. So the first movement is, you know, when God creates light, and then there's the land and the water. And so the whole point of that song was, if I was creating a soundtrack to God creating the world in 6 days, what would that sound like?
Oh, wow. Okay.
That's the thought.
That's an amazing thought.
It's an amazing thought, and I definitely didn't do it justice, but I'll try again in heaven.
Well, I've thought a little bit about this when I read one of the Narnia books. I think it was The Magician's Nephew.
Yes, correct.
I think, where it shows Aslan actually singing Narnia into creation.
Yeah, it's a beautiful thought, isn't it?
And that always struck me as there must have been music. There must have been music when God was creating.
Of course.
Yeah. Okay, so that's awesome. That's changed the way I'm going to listen to that.
Okay, cool.
Okay, the next one is Nomvula, or After the Rain. Let's play it, and then you can share some thoughts about it.
Okay, great.
Well.
Thank you.
Cool. So where did this one come from?
That one, kind of the whole song came to me in about, well, the song's 4 minutes, and I think the whole thing came to me in about 2 minutes. I was at university working on my final electroacoustic recording project, and it's a project that we'd been working on for 6 months, and the recording studio at university was kind of a difficult place to get into because there was a schedule and a list for, you know, you had to book time to get in there. Most people didn't stick to that. So you would arrive there and hope that no one had taken the studio from you, or you'd have to get there and then force them out. And I got there the day before the project was due to bounce my track and to, you know, just do some final touches to it. And there was a full on Muskandi band. Like there was like 10 musicians in there and they were busy recording an album. So I don't know how, but they managed to, you know, score the studio, and they were in the middle of recording their album. So it was really difficult to, you know, I couldn't say to them, "Hey guys, you've all got to, you know, catch taxis and go back to where you came from, 'cause I need this now." So I just sat there listening to them, and the groove was absolutely infectious. It was amazing, you know, and you find most kind of like ethnic organic music works like that, where when you listen to the individual elements, they might be rough. The timing, you know, might not be that good, and the instruments don't sound very good, but together it just makes this amazing vibe. And yes. I heard them playing and I was so inspired by them. I went to one of the piano rooms downstairs and basically came up with that song in about 2 minutes.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Yeah. And I've got some amazing musicians playing on that song in particular. You could almost take the guitar out of that song and just be left with the band, because their playing was so good. So it's definitely one of my favorite songs in terms of performance and in terms of the way it sounds on the album.
Okay. Brilliant. And then before we play it, tell us about Mother Tongue.
Mother Tongue was kind of like a shifting point in my career, because I recorded all the electric songs on my album, and then I'd always had it in the back of my mind that I was going to record two acoustic songs and just stick them at the end of the album. And that had always been the plan. And then eventually it came time to, well, we've got to wrap the album up. And I thought, oh yeah, I've still got to record those two acoustic songs. So I took a guitar and I went into studio and I recorded, and we mixed the song, the two acoustic songs, and we sent them off for mastering, and they came back and they just sounded absolutely appalling. Like it really, really was, it really wasn't good at all. And I was very heartbroken by that, and I didn't know what to do, because I thought, but I've composed these pieces, and you know, it was an expensive studio and the guitar was an expensive guitar. I don't understand. So I phoned a friend of mine, the best person I could possibly get hold of to talk about acoustic guitar recording, and that was Guy Buttery, and who's also an amazing fingerstyle guitar player and guru from Durban. And he said, well, why don't you come over? I've got a studio. We can try and see if we can get a better result here. And so I went over to his studio, and he was burning incense and playing Indian raga music, and it's a really, really cool vibe, quite different, but super cool nonetheless. And we just had an evening of recording two songs, and they came out absolutely stunningly. And Guy did such a great job. He engineered and mixed to those two songs, one of which was Mother Tongue. And basically when I heard the recording come out as pleasingly as it did, I then figured that I could do the acoustic thing pretty much full time, because I could make a product that sounded that pleasing. And it's also that I think that song, more than any other, is the song that I've had the most response to from my audiences, in terms of, you know, saying how it meant something to them. Or I've had people coming to me asking me to learn, you know, they want guitar lessons because they want to learn a song off my album, and invariably it's Mother Tongue.
Okay, well, here it is, Mother Tongue. Thank you. Beautiful stuff. You were saying that this was almost a changing point in your career as you started to focus more on the solo acoustic after this track. So the new album that you're busy with, this is going to be mostly acoustic?
I would say like 98% acoustic. I might have one electric guitar solo on it. I'm right in the midst of recording that right now. It's the album at this point looks like it's going to be a part one, part two type of deal. So I'm busy. I'm at the moment looking to finish off part one within the next week or so and send that off for mastering. And then I'll get to part two later in the year, but it's totally acoustic. And it's also different because the last time what I did was I composed music and then I went and recorded it and then I started performing it. And this way I took an extra year off of the recording process just to perform music and get music ready. And so I've had more preparation in a sense. So I've performed the music in some cases for 3 years already. And know how it works and know how what works with audiences and what people respond to and stuff. So in that sense, I'm hoping that I've learned this time around and I can make a richer musical offering.
Okay, great. So I saw a video of you doing one of the songs, I think, which is a traditional Sotho song.
Yes, correct. Morokini, it's a song of greeting.
Okay, where did you find out about it?
That, funnily enough, was a song that my school choir used to perform, believe it or not, and it was always the song that we would start the concerts with, and it just had so much energy, and it was just such a good song that when we performed it, we couldn't get anything wrong after that. Basically, we knew that we were going to go on stage, and play Morokini, and everything would be good after that, no matter what happened. And so I kind of tried to translate some of that onto the guitar also because, I'm very interested in the Maskandi style of playing and I can't do it at all. I don't know a thing about it, but it's very interesting. And so if I could try and translate the way I play, into a semi Maskandi ish, like wannabe Maskandi thing, then hopefully that'd be something a little bit different.
Okay. Oh, looking forward to it. When are you expecting to be finished with part one and part two?
Part one, I don't want to make any promises, but hopefully I will be releasing that in May. And then part two will look at Jan, Feb 2018. Or what are we now? 2019, rather.
Okay. All right. Good stuff. So have there been any mentors in your journey? So apart from the heroes like Tommy Emmanuel and such, people in your life who've really encouraged you to follow this course?
I think so. Music's a strange one because I've seen people who have lots of people encouraging them into music, and that's actually bad for them. For example, there's some artists who everyone around them tells them how good they are and how promising they are, and that's actually detrimental to their art. And it's actually been, in the long run, discouraging for them because no one tells them the stuff they need to hear. So I try not to have encouraging people around me, as weird as that might sound. Find it's totally an internal process, where I get inspired by musicians and music. I try and listen to the best in the world at all times and listen to the standard that I'm trying to attain to. And then any kind of like spiritual or mentoring, guidance, anything like that takes place through my elders at the church and my family and my parents and my wife. And I try and get as much of that from them as I can. But that still said, I have had a couple of people who have very much been very influential for me in terms of mentoring. The first one I would say was my choir mistress at high school, Angela Stevens. And she ran a tight ship, and I learned a lot about being on time and being prepared and, the discipline of music. I learned a lot of that from her. And then two of my lecturers at university, Neil Gonzalez, who's a phenomenal jazz pianist, and he played for Johnny Clegg for a couple of years. He played and toured with Johnny Clegg, and he basically lectured me. I had him for 2 hours a day, every day for 5 or 6 years. And I just learned so much about kind of, the more esoteric side of music and improvisation and the importance of music through him. And then my guitar lecturer at university, Demi Fernandez, as well. He's just a phenomenal flamenco guitar player. And he studied in Spain, and he got to meet Paco de Lucía, and met all these amazing players, and has been influenced by them. And also, I learned a lot about personal discipline and making plans, and kind of scheduling your practicing, and basically just being good. How nothing else matters in music, in terms like your job as a musician is to get good, and you let other people worry about your fame and your other stuff. What I learned from Demi was your job as a musician is just to get good.
Okay. Yes. All right. Any advice for somebody thinking of going into music full time in this country?
Yes, absolutely. Just get good. Because I think I also teach a lot of young kids, which is a huge blessing to me. And I see a lot of them, they have stars in their eyes. And, that kind of where I was at eight or 9 years ago, where they want to make that song that becomes a number one song on the radio, and they want to play for 40,000 people, and they want everyone to scream their names and all of that. And, so from a Christian perspective, I'd say, it's about God's glory, not yours. But
yeah,
I suppose from a slightly more secular point of view that, that everyone might agree with, if I could, is your job is to get good as a musician, like I was saying. And the whole fame and stuff like that actually can be a distraction. And I see a lot of musicians who are 19 or 20, and they throw their whole lives into a band, and they commit absolutely everything to a band or to a song or an EP or something. And they spend all their money and all their time on this EP. And usually, they might get onto the radio, and they might, they might get a couple of festivals and, play with some pretty big acts. And the problem is, because they've neglected that formative kind of artistic growth, as you get older, you don't have time for that, to sit for 4 or 5 hours practicing your instrument a day. And as they get older, they don't have the skill set to maintain that career, throughout until they're 70 or 80. And that's why washed up musicians are such a common thing. Because they wanted the fame, and they got it, and they had it for a while, and then it disappeared. And so that's what I would encourage musicians is you don't want to be at your best when you're 23. You want to be at your best when you're 70. If that makes sense. Kind of like Tommy Emmanuel. I mean, he's just grown, or, an Eric Clapton, even though a guy like Eric Clapton is just an anomaly. Those guys, they just get better and better and better and more mature, and they become like fine wine. They just get better with age. And, like Tommy Emmanuel's audience grows each year, his influence grows each year. And I would encourage young musicians to have a long-term perspective on their careers, not a 3 or 4 year perspective on their careers.
Awesome. Very helpful. What are you up to in the next couple of weeks and months, apart from finishing up part one? What else are you busy with?
At the moment, I suppose I'm composing music for part two. And then I've got Splashy Fen coming up, which is a lot of fun. I'll be playing on Saturday night on Easter weekend at Splashy. And then at our church, we make a big fuss of Easter Sunday. So that's one of my favorites. We're going to be performing a new song, a Keith and Kristen Getty song called Christ Is Risen, He Is Risen Indeed. And I can't wait to have the choir and the band and to rehearse for that. And that's always a lot of fun and very time consuming. So that's a lot of fun. And then some shows, some touring to Cape Town and Joburg in May. I believe I'll be in Johannesburg in May for the Guitar Expo. I might be there with one of my sponsors, Guitar Gallery, but I don't want to put anything in concrete yet. So don't quote me. Don't quote me on that.
Okay, great, man. Well, where can people find out about you, find your music, follow what you're up to?
I'm on all the major social media platforms, I suppose. So Facebook, Instagram, Twitter. I have my website, sebgoldswain.com. I've got my music up on iTunes and Amazon Music and Nokia Music and Spotify and all the good places as well. But yeah, I think everything I kind of channel through my Facebook page. So that's that, or my website would be the two best places to go to.
Well, Seb, thanks so much for being on the show. It's been really good to chat to you. I've really enjoyed it. And yeah, God bless you as you just carry on doing everything for His glory As you said, that verse from 1 Corinthians is also one of my favorites because it just informs absolutely everything that we're doing. So just thank you very much. And yeah, God bless you as you go out and keep making music for him.
Great. Thanks so much, Luke. Thank you for having me.
Well, thank you so much for tuning in. I really hope that you got something out of this conversation we had. And go and support Seb. Go and buy his music and see where he's playing and go and support. He's a great guy. And let's all support each other as Christian songwriters and Christian artists here in South Africa. So please subscribe. Please share this with all your friends. And I hope that you'll tune in next week. God bless.